Support for WPR comes from Tomorrow River Community Virtual School, delivering Waldorf-inspired live virtual lessons to grades 4K through 8th, open to all Wisconsin students. More is at trcvs.org.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret has the day off. Coming up later in the show, we'll talk to a photographer who's trying to show Native Americans as they truly are by photographing a member of every tribe in the United States. First, we take a look at some news regarding racial disparity in the state, and the news isn't good. According to a new national report, the well-being of African American children in Wisconsin is worse than anywhere else in the nation, and there is a stark discrepancy between white children and their peers. So what are the reasons behind that, and what can we do about it? Joining us now is Ken Taylor, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. Ken, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon, Veronica. Thanks for having me on your program.
Ken, first off, discouraging news for Wisconsin and the African-American communities here. What's your reaction to the news?
Well, I wish that I could say that I was surprised, but the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families has been working on this issue for a number of years, and we knew that we had challenges. We've been working more recently on a Dane County-specific program, and we knew that we had high racial disparities here in Madison and Dane County, where we're physically located. But we also knew that there were challenges across the state. But I think it really is a wake-up call for all of us across Wisconsin to see that of all the states in the nation, our African-American kids are the most challenged.
Now, the report uses something called the Race for Results Index. It compares how children are progressing on key milestones across racial and ethnic groups at a national level and at a state level. Can you fill us in on the details on what the study found?
Sure. They looked at 12 different indicators that they could share, or they could look at across all the different states, things like children living in low poverty areas, or high school graduation, or math proficiency, or preschool enrollment. And so they compared every state and all ethnic groups, and they put all of that into an index, as they describe it, and then looked at all the states and all the different ethnic groups to see how they compare to one another. And so when we did that, we had very different rankings across our different ethnic groups. So for our white children, we were actually ranked number 10, and that's in keeping with a lot of the rankings that we find in Wisconsin that show that our kids are doing generally pretty well. But we find that that hides the challenges that many kids in communities of color face. And so we found that in Wisconsin, our African-American children were ranked last. Our Asian children were ranked 37th, and our Latino children were ranked 17th, and our Native American children were ranked 12th out of the 25 states that got rankings. So we really do have a wide range of rankings based on race and ethnicity here in Wisconsin.
Now, other states did poorly by some measures, including Mississippi, for instance, but was it a surprise to see Wisconsin with the lowest scores?
Yeah, I think that it is a wake-up call for all of us who care about all of our kids, and the idea that when you look, people tend to think that those sorts of things happen elsewhere, and you know, when we look at how kids are doing, oftentimes states in the South, and you know, Mississippi and Louisiana and some of the other southern states seemed most challenged, and the fact that upper Midwestern states and that our own state in Wisconsin is dead last really should be a wake up call for all of us, because I don't think it's in keeping with how we view ourselves, view how we support our neighbors, and view the opportunities that we like to provide for all of our kids.
Now, I understand that you're hoping that Wisconsin will respond with a two-pronged approach, one prong focusing on families and supporting families and giving them a track to employment and family-supporting jobs, and the other is to focus on the kids. Tell us about what you think Wisconsin should do, how they should start responding.
Well, we know that investments in kids are very beneficial, and we know that they have a big return on investment. And one of the biggest is in high-quality early care and education. And so historically, Wisconsin has been doing good work in that arena, But we find over the last few years that there's been a fairly dramatic decrease in the level of investment that we're making as a state in early care and education. We are working hard as a state to improve the quality, but at the same time, we're decreasing the funding. And so that's an example of a challenge that we have that we think if we could make more investment in high-quality early care and education where we know there's a big return on that investment, it ends up saving us money in the long run, that we think that we'd be in better shape.
Now, give us a little bit of the why here and the how. How did Wisconsin end up here? It didn't happen overnight. What went wrong?
Well, it is a long-term issue, and the solutions are going to be long-term as well. But I think part of it is that because we have relatively small communities of color, that the challenges that they're facing were hidden in the overall relatively high averages that we have, whereas in other parts of the country that are further ahead of us as far as the demographic change that's coming across the country, that some of that is hidden. I also think that we have some particular challenges. So as I said, we've been working on this issue here in Dane County, and we find that there are some particular challenges here in Dane County that, you know, explain some of the challenges. So one of them is that the employment expectations and credentials that people need in order to get into jobs are much higher than many of the – there's a disconnect between those and the job seekers. We also know that there's isolation and lack of connection between neighborhoods where a lot of children of color live and broader community. So there's that lack of connection. So there's some specific challenges here that we think that we need to address.
Any sense about how politicians, lawmakers are reacting to this news?
Well, we haven't heard from any so far, but I think, like I said earlier, I think it should be a wake-up call to all of us, not just politicians, but all of us across the state. And, you know, this idea that sort of a mirror is being held up to us, and I don't think that this is really in keeping with Wisconsin values, you know, that really values community and opportunity and fairness. And so we are anxiously awaiting, you know, response from our political leaders about what they can do, but really what we all need to do as a state to address this challenge that should be an embarrassment to all of us.
So if you're a parent, an African-American parent, and you've got a child going through the schools here in Wisconsin, what message do you think Wisconsin should be sending to them about what Wisconsin will do to tackle the problem and to, I don't know, maybe apologize in a sense for what's happened with these results?
Yeah, well, I really think it's important to be looking forward and not you know, try to figure out. We need to know how we got into this situation, but not really so much about blame, but about forward momentum. And so I think one of the most important things is to connect with those families, with those parents, and develop relationships with them to find out, well, what are the challenges that you face, and how can we, how can the system better respond to your needs, and make sure that as we're developing solutions for this, that the voice of those who are most challenged in our society are heard as we're developing the solutions to address this real deep challenge in our state.
So do you expect that to be a key part of this puzzle, really opening up a dialogue that's constantly flowing between families and educational institutions to figure out how to change?
Well, I think that is essential, and we started to do that. There's quite a dynamic conversation happening here in Dane County that is, you know, adding on to the many conversations that have happened here before. But I do want to emphasize that it's not just the educational institutions that we need to be looking at, because in a lot of ways they're receiving these challenges, and there's only so much that they can do within the schoolhouse walls to address poverty, to address health care issues, to address inequality when it comes to employment and
right.
pay and all those sorts of things. And so while education is a huge piece of this, and particularly moving forward, I also think it's really important not to lay all the challenges on their doors, because there's so much that happens outside of the educational setting that we need to address.
Sure, and we're about out of time here, but why don't we finish up there? What other institutions do you think need to be looking at this and reacting?
Well, I think that all sectors need to be looking at this. So I think that the public institutions, state and local government, but I also think there's a big role for private sector employers to think about their own hiring practices and their own wage practices and their own mentoring practices. And I think that neighborhoods and communities and families all have a role. So I think it's going to require a multi-sector, long-term, dedicated effort to address this.
Ken, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on your program.
We've been talking to Ken Taylor, the Executive Director of the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. When you think of Native Americans, maybe your mind goes to the past, to stereotypes or anachronisms, people maybe in feathered headdresses with bows and arrows. Well, our next guest is working to put an authentic face on Native Americans today with her photography project 562. Not only is she trying to change the way Indigenous people are seen in the United States, she's trying to discover what it means to be Native American today. Makita Wilbur joins us now. She's the photographer and educator behind Project 562. Matika, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, how did the Project 562 first come into being? Where did it come from?
Well, you know, I've been a photographer for the last 10 years, maybe 11 now, and I began to realize that there really wasn't an accurate representation of contemporary Native America in massive media, both through the lecturing that I was doing about my previous exhibit, We Are One People, and Reemerge, and also just by Google searching. If you type in African American or Asian American, you'll find young, contemporary, or regular folks. If you type Native American, most times what you'll find is an image from the early 1900s. And so my goal really is about creating a positive Indigenous role model and new image from this century that represents who we are today.
And I read that there was also a dream that came into play.
Oh, that's a longer story. Yeah. Well, you know, I went to the Rocky Mountain School of Photography and Brooks Institute of Photography in Santa Barbara in California. Mm-hmm. And when I was done with school, I pursued advertising in Los Angeles. And I've been working in L.A. for about, 9 months after college. And, it was a devastation, really, because I realized that I didn't want to be in advertising. And here I'd studied advertising. And so I took a job in South America, actually. And I went and traveled all through Ecuador and Peru and Bolivia and began photographing Indigenous people in the Amazon and in several different places. And I guess I'd been working down there about 3 years when I had this dream with my grandmother. She said, "What are you doing photographing these Indians when you haven't even worked with your own? You know, go home." And I did. I went home to Swinomish, where I'm from, and began my first series called We Are One People, where I photographed elders of Coast Salish tribes, and I asked them questions related to identity and spirituality, love, war. Really, it began my own questioning, what does it mean to be a young Native woman in a contemporary society? How do I learn to balance my cultural traditions with Western value systems?
So you took the advice of your grandmother in the dream, and you talked about the goal of this project to photograph all of the Native tribes in the United States, 562 at this point, and counting, I guess. But you've got a bigger goal, too. You're talking about changing the way people see Native Americans. Why is right now a good time to do that, to put a real face on Native peoples in the United States?
Well, That's a really good question. Why is it necessary? You know, between 1990 and 2000, there were nearly 6,000 blockbuster released films. Only 12 included American Indians. Of those 12 films, 10 showed Indians as impoverished or beaten down by society. 10 is continually in conflict with white or as a noble savage and spiritual warrior. However, the image of the contemporary business person, the artist, the photographer, the teacher, the doctor, the young professional, those images were largely absent. What's interesting is how that image manifests itself into our psyche. You see, one of my mentors, Dr. Stephanie Freiberg, who's actually from my dad's tribe, from Tulalip, who's a professor from Stanford, did a study. She's a psychologist, and she went to all of these different tribal schools and public schools around the country, and she showed younger kids between ages of 8 and 14 images from different backgrounds. And she would ask them questions related to self-esteem. And then when she would show them an image of a young Native person or of the stereotypical Native person, the Pocahontas, dances with wolves, Twilight, the Redskins, you know, their self-esteem would go down by almost 60%. And when shown to the white counterpart, their self-esteem would be raised. And so what that tells me is that the image of the Native person is perpetuating this this negativity. And I just think it's time for that to stop in 2014, don't you?
I think your images are incredible, and they definitely changed my thinking. That they're incredibly striking, and I wonder if you could talk about the ground rules. There's only a couple things you ask of your subjects. What are they?
Well, I ask quite a bit from my subjects. I ask them if I could stay with them.
Besides crashing on their couches, what do they need to be photographed by you?
I ask that they be photographed within their indigenous territory, which usually extends beyond the boundaries of our reservations because, you know, the history of the reservation system has changed quite a bit over the last 150 years. And so within their indigenous territory, and I ask people, which sometimes, you know, I break the rules, you know, like, for instance, Jessica Metcalf is Turtle Mountain Chippewa, but I photographed her on Odom land because that's where we met up. So sometimes I break my own rules. And I also ask them, I ask them where they would like to be photographed in a location that's important to them. And then, of course, there's a series of questions before I photograph them, getting to know them, really asking them questions related to stereotypes and identity. I ask them to tell me some interesting details about their tribe, why they chose to live on the reservation, why they maybe chose to leave, how they chose their partner. We talk about blood quantum, we talk about sovereignty, self-governance, protecting natural resources. It's a very long interview process.
I want to ask you about one of the photographs that you took of Caleb and Jerob Dunlap from the Lake Superior Chippewa. Now, that's our neck of the woods, and they are having a blast, I'm guessing, in Lake Superior. Can you tell us anything about that photo shoot?
The Twindians, yeah, Caleb and Jared. They're wonderful. I just love them. And actually, that photograph was taken on the canoe journey out this year at the landing in Quileute. But we are making plans to come to your region, hopefully next spring after the snow melts.
I don't know when that's going to be. Might not be anytime soon. Well, we've got a little bit of time left, and I know you clocked about 60,000 miles on this trip. Can you tell us a couple of the stories that stayed with you from this?
Oh, wow. You know, I have to tell you that the most amazing part of my journey is that I've been really welcome and taken care of on the road. You know, I think it's really easy for us when we're at home and we're working every day and we're trying to get food on the table and we get caught up in the hustle and we watch the news, and it's easy to be sort of hopeless about the state of humanity. And I just have to tell you that people have been so kind to me and really welcomed me. I don't know how else to say it. It's just been overwhelming. And the incredible support that I've gained through Kickstarter contributors and the media across the country, I think it's what's really inspiring for me has been people are supportive of seeing a change. And that really gives me hope. But, you know, I mean, road stories, oh, gosh, you know, I mean, like traveling in to have a supai at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, that was a wild adventure. And, you know, everything from land controversies and water controversies out with the Paiutes to going to Pachina ceremonies in the Southwest. And it's just been so incredible.
Matika, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about it today.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. I'm really very honored.
We've been talking to Matika Wilbur, photographer and educator, and she's behind the Project 562, and you can catch some of her pictures on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're interrupting our regular show to make an important announcement. As you may have noticed, my regular co-host Rob Ferret is off the show today. Rob is changing directions in his career, and he'll be going back to school to get a PhD in cosmetology. He's got a lot of gifts in that field. Beginning next week, Rob is going to be replaced by Prairie Home Companion host Garrison Keillor, who for unknown reasons has agreed to take a drastic cut in both pay and prestige. We hope you understand why we had to move in that direction. But before we give our last farewell to Rob, I just want to say, happy April Fool's Day. Rob is with his family today, and he'll be back tomorrow. Okay, so there was my shot at an April Fool's joke. Rob, fans can blame the producers of the show if they gave you a shock. Right now, though, we dig into what makes something funny. Director of the Humor Research Lab in Boulder, Colorado, Peter McGraw, and award-winning journalist Joel Warner teamed up to crack the code on what makes us laugh. After traveling the world to places like Tanzania, Japan, Palestine, they wrote their new book, which is out today. It's called The Humor Code, A Global Search for What Makes Things Funny. Peter and Joel, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having us on.
Okay, so as we just heard, today is April Fool's Day, which usually is associated with a certain kind of humor, more a prank than anything else, usually making you think something is true when it's really not. How successful is that kind of humor, Peter?
Well, it depends a little bit on who you're doing it with and how well you thought out this this prank. Do you have any idea how long your producers had been planning that one?
I think it was just hatched this morning, actually. So, yeah, it's not an elaborately thought-out prank, but I think it should shock Rob when he gets back.
Yeah, I think the key with this idea is that it can't obviously be a fake prank, especially on April Fool's Day. There has to be some belief. So you started to lose me at PhD in cosmetology at that point. At that moment, it seemed maybe a little bit too obvious.
I was going to say poultry science. Would that have been better?
To become a butcher?
I don't know. All right, so it has to be something that's believable. And Joel, you traveled with Peter to get a feel globally for what makes things funny and experience culture, the humor culture in different places around the world. What did you discover as you traveled around? Is there something as universal funny?
We asked that very question specifically when we went to Japan, because for us, we assumed that the comedy in Japan would be the most foreign imaginable for Americans like us. And in truth, the comedy that we experienced there, these sadistic Japanese game shows we sat in on, it did seem pretty foreign to us. But then when we sat down and interacted with some of these comedians who were boiling their faces in these giant pots of soup for these shows, we found that we could connect in more universal humor, kind of interpersonal.
Can you describe one of the game shows for us that you sat in on?
Sure. So one thing that most people probably don't realize about these Japanese game shows that many people might have seen on YouTube clips is that the majority of the contestants are trained comedians. The belief is the average everyday Japanese person wouldn't be able to show the level of pain and turmoil that they want for these shows. So we set it on a show where the contestant literally had to pick up pieces of fish out of boiling soup, and depending on how fast he was able to do this, his colleagues would be crushed inside a glass case by a giant inflating balloon.
And did you think that was funny while you were there?
We were not laughing out loud. Pete, would you agree with that?
Yeah, you know, for us it was actually, it seemed a little too painful. We were a little bit too close to it all. You know, we could really see that this was not a fake gag, and that the comedian wasn't actually overacting in this case.
And Peter, you've developed something, sort of a universal theory of humor called, to paraphrase, benign violation. So some sort of expected convention is violated, but it's harmless. And that, it seems like, is what makes things funny. Can you flesh that out a little for us? Where did that come from, that idea?
Well, so I think this idea, like many of our psychological and emotional experiences, you know, has its roots in our more primitive ancestors. So the idea that benign violations really developed originally out of physical and ecological threats. So physical threats that ended up being harmless, social interactions that could be that were threatening but could be explained away. So you can see this in non-human primates and apes and chimps in rough and tumble play. When they engage in this kind of play fighting, it's actually typically the victim who laughs. This is called play panting, but this is sort of the background to, human laughter, this ha-ha-ha kind of sound. And one of the really fascinating things that we learned during the Humor Code Project was it seems that even rats tend to experience a similar kind of physiological reaction, a positive reaction in these ultrasonic chirps that some people call rat laughter.
I want to talk about the benign violation theory and try to get an example here. This is Louis C.K., who, Peter, you actually talked to and tried to get some some wisdom out of. It didn't go that well, but we'll listen to his comedy, which is what he's known for, not his philosophizing about humor. And this is from his HBO special called Oh My God. And he's just brought up this notion that each person has two sides to their brain, a good side and a bad side, and of course side, and a but maybe side. And here's a clip from that.
Okay, like of course, children who have nut allergies need to be protected. Of course. We have to segregate their food from nuts, have their medication available at all times, and anybody who manufactures or serves food needs to be aware of deadly nut allergies. Of course. But maybe, if touching a nut kills you, you're supposed to die.
Okay, Louis C.K. doing what he does, and Peter, why is that funny?
Well, one of the things is that Louis C.K. has worked, I think, really hard to make that bit, which really sits on the edge of going too far, finding a way to make that funny. And the way he does this is that he spends a lot of time setting up this idea that in his heart, he knows that you need to protect these people. This is the of course. And then he says the thing that deep down we might be thinking that we often don't want to say. And that's the but maybe part. That's the violation. So he sets up a way to make this violation benign. And my guess is that he spent, you know, a year trying to get that bit exactly right in order to get that huge laugh so that the audience can see this is wrong, yet okay.
Joel, stand-up comedians like Louis C.K., they develop their material sometimes over years, honing it to make the joke just exactly funny. Do you think they know what they're doing, or are they just sort of noodling around?
Oh, I don't think they're noodling around at all. What's funny is that we met with Louis C.K. briefly before a show in Denver, and he, at that point, acted like your stereotypical road-weary comic. He was not that interested in hearing about Pete's theory, and actually shut Pete down after just a minute or two, saying he doesn't think it's as simple as one scientific theory for humor. However, it's clear that successful comedians like Louis C.K. are experimenting. These guys are using science, whether they call it or not. That these guys experiment with the material night after night after night, and they look at the results and they tweak it. And there's not one right process. There's not one set of rules these guys follow. But if you're going to be successful, you have to create some sort of formula, some sort of process that works for you.
And yet, Peter, people were kind of resistant to the notion that there could be sort of a theory on what makes things funny, that even though it's this universal thing that everybody does, everybody everywhere laughs at something or the other, why has there been resistance to try to pin it down and figure out what it is, why it happens?
I think the resistance is twofold. So some of the resistance are from the professionals out there, the Louis C.K.'s of the world. And we chalk that up to the magician who doesn't want his tricks revealed. So if the audience is sitting there trying to dissect the act, you can see the secret sauce, they worry that it may diminish their product in a sense. The other part is that I think that people enjoy the mystery of it all, that the idea that comedy is this sort of special thing, and you know, science has other more important things to do. Don't go messing with this little bit of magic that I tend to enjoy. My feeling about this is that it's such an important thing, and there's enough people who do it badly, that if we can get some additional insights through science, it seems worth trying to crack the humor code.
Well, we're talking right now with Peter McGraw, director of the Humor Research Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder, and Joe Warner, award-winning former staff writer of the alt weekly Westword. And we're talking about their new book, The Humor Code, A Global Search for What Makes Things Funny. And we'd like to hear from you. What do you think makes something funny? Is it possible to pin it down and to have a theory that works across the board? Can anything be funny in the right hands? And what about an April Fool's joke that you played that went over pretty well? You can share it with us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. It's April Fool's Day, and we're back with Peter McGraw and Joel Warner, the authors of the book, The Humor Code, A Global Search for What Makes Things Funny. And we want to hear from you on this. What do you think makes something funny? What tickles your funny bone more than anything else? Is it possible to have a grand unified theory of funny? And you can also call up and share some of your April Fool's pranks. Our number, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And Peter, certain questions have been kicking around comedy for a long time. For instance, who's funnier, men or women, Democrats or Republicans? And in that last vein, Stephen Colbert has had a big hand in political comedy lately. Let's listen to his take on the Bible.
The people who work with the homeless say don't give them money. It's a bad thing. You're an enabler. You're enabling their alcohol or their drug habit.
Remember what Jesus said about giving things to people you don't know. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. Suckers, this is a fake beard. I'm secretly rich. My dad's God. Burn!
Stephen Colbert. Peter, how do you think Stephen Colbert does when it comes to funny and applied to your theory? Is he working the same theorem that everyone else is?
Well, he's been doing quite well until his show's Twitter account took his jokes out of context. One of the things that Stephen does very nicely is he plays this character. He plays this sort of over-the-top pundit who has really extreme views. And yet, at the same time, he's making fun, he's satirizing the things that seem to be wrong in the world with the way politicians act, the way the media acts, the hypocrisy that we see sort of day in and day out as he reports the news. I think lately the line's getting a little bit blurred between who Stephen Colbert is as a performer and then Stephen Colbert as just a regular kind of guy. But he certainly seems to have that magic touch. He also has a pretty strong writer's room, I suspect. So it's not just Stephen who's writing these jokes, but a group of really smart, funny people along the way who are really hitting that sweet spot most of the time.
Let's go to our phone lines now. We've got Catherine on the line from Evansville. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I am good.
What do you think?
Well, I played a prank on a whole entire class today. I'm an educational assistant, and I was in a science class with a teacher, and we were in on it together. And I told her, when you see me stand up and go to the window, I need you to just ask me what I'm doing. So I went over to the window, and I started snapping pictures on my camera phone. And as you know, you can hear that. It clicks. And she goes, Mrs. Short, are you taking pictures? What are you doing? And I said, oh, my gosh, there's a ton of deer out here. I said, there's like 10 deer. They're right out here. And the kids were like, really? And I said, yeah, come see. So they came over to the window, and they're looking, and they're opening the other blind, and they're looking. And I'm like, right there, don't you see? And they're like, no, where are they? Right there. And finally, I just said, April Fool's. And they said, what? And I said, April Fool's. And they went, oh, my gosh, you got the whole class.
With your imaginary deer herd.
Yes.
Okay, thanks, Catherine. The students of Catherine disappointed. They did not see any deer. Joel, does that fit the formula?
Oh, sure. I mean, this was very much a mild violation. And clearly in a class like that where folks would know each other, you want to have mild violation things that folks can laugh at together, you know. Where, you know, if you were trying to get a whole, you know, something on television or the radio or whatnot, you might want a more, you know, a slightly more serious violation, a slightly more extensive prank. But I think it's the perfect thing to do when you're joking around with friends and colleagues.
Now, before we go too much further, in the same vein, actually, one thing that comes up is whether or not where the line is for humor. If you can find humor everywhere, if there are certain places that are just a humor black hole and you cannot make jokes there. And one place that you sort of put this to the test to is in Palestine, where you ask the question, can you find humor where you least expect it? Joel, can you tell us what happened there?
Well, we decided to go to Palestine. We didn't have much of a plan other than we truly believed that we were going to find a lot of comedy in the West Bank. And thankfully for us in the book, we did. We found the West Bank's version of Saturday Night Live. We found stand-up comedians. We found professors who were dedicating their careers to collecting the jokes that the Palestinians were creating. And it makes a lot of sense. I mean, if you think about the benign violation theory, if you're living in a place that's full of violations, you're going to find ways to make those benign.
Are there places, though, Peter, that are just funny free zones? Not in terms of a geographical place, but maybe a situation that really nobody should ever joke about ever.
You know, some of it depends on what culture you belong to. So in Japan, one of the things that was really striking was the lack of laughter in public places, in businesses, in educational settings. But that's just because the Japanese have very clear delineations about where it's okay to make jokes and where it's not. In the United States, it's a much more open culture in that way, where there's almost no place that's off limits. Even if people say that a funeral is no place to laugh, you can actually still find a great deal of joking and reminiscing and so on. We actually spent some time in Jerusalem, and we met a Holocaust survivor there. And we asked her about where was there humor? Did she experience humor? And what her take on it was that yes, it happened. It happened infrequently, and it happened in sort of moments of safety, moments of satiation after people had had a meal when they were in a work camp. But her time in Auschwitz, she couldn't recall many times where things were okay enough for people to be able to share a laugh. Things were just so dark, so depressing, so scary that you really couldn't find the kind of laughs that you wanted, even amongst the most party individuals.
I guess that gets at the benign part of it, that you can't be in a situation that's too dire or you kind of cross that line.
Well, I think that you get that with gallows humor sometimes. You know, you get people making jokes at the guillotine. And my guess about that, so first of all, universities won't let you study that kind of stuff for obvious reasons. the other though is that I think that these are people who have accepted their fate in some way. And so they're comfortable with their own demise, and they're able to laugh in the face of death. you know, most people aren't able to get to that place for obvious reasons.
Let's go back to our phones now. Eric is joining us from Endeavor. Hi, Eric.
I know we're out of time, so I'll just make this quick, Victoria. And I'll take my laptop off the air. But last year, I called my wife. We had taken our kids out of school and put them in a different school in the next county over. And about a week later, I had a coworker call my wife and explain that she was a sheriff's deputy and she had a warrant for her arrest and needed to turn herself in.
Ah.
Pretty entertaining for
me. Yeah. That's a good one, Dan. Thanks a lot. Sorry, I was just getting back at Eric for calling me Victoria. Anyway, what do you think about that practical joke?
I don't know. I want to know if they're still married.
Yeah, that was a good question. It sounds like it went over. He sounded pretty happy, so I'm guessing Eric and his wife are still going strong. Let's go next to Jess in Viroqua. Hi, Jess.
Hi. I'm a firm believer that all comedy is rooted in other people's pain, and that can be demonstrated by if anyone has ever seen a video of someone being kicked between the legs and laughed, it's funny because it's not you.
So kind of a Schadenfreude theory of comedy. Peter, is there anything to that?
Well, certainly, I can't agree with the idea that all comedy follows from that observation, but certainly a lot of it does. Right? So you think about the slapstick comedy, you think about the comedy that you found in the Charlie Chaplin silent films. It certainly had this notion that what Hobbes called this notion of sudden glory, and really translates into a theory of superiority. The issue, though, is that ignores, for instance, things like self-deprecating humor, where you make fun of yourself, and you do so in such a way that you entertain others at your own expense. And that actually is a very useful way to do it. So when Joel and I were in Los Angeles, we looked at who was funny, and we spent a lot of time hanging out with comedians. And one thing that we noticed was that a lot of stand-up comedians, they start with that kind of a joke. They make fun of their imperfections, they get the laugh, and then it gives them some license to point out what's wrong with the rest of the world.
So you get a little humor credit.
Exactly. You get a little license, you get the sure laugh, and then you can move on to other topics.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
And Joel, it's great to have you along, too. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Peter McGraw, director of the Humor Research Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder, and Joel Warner, award-winning former staff writer for the alt-weekly Westword. Together, they are co-authors of the book The Humor Code, a global search for what makes things funny.